Good afternoon. Happy Friday. Happy St. Patrick's Day. If you are Irish or like alcohol or like the color green, any of those things, you're good. If you're a fan of Notre Dame, we're playing in March Madness right now. Any of those things. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm Blake Murphy. Ben Ennis is off, I don't know, enjoying life with his wife and kids during March break. I'm not sure how any of that works. Justin Bourne is here, though, to fill us in on what dad life is like on a week like March break. Going to talk Leaf stuff, of course. But how's your March break been?
I mean, you know, fine. I don't know the difference anymore, as you mentioned, with wife and kids and all that. Are you just, every day is the same. Are you Irish? Murphy? What are you?
I mean, if you traced it back enough generations, probably. But my dad's side of the family have been in Newfoundland for long enough that, like, our family did not keep good enough records.
That's Canada's Ireland, really.
Yeah, like the 23andMe or whatever those things are, just say mixed white person. I've got my 25% generic Spanish and 75% mixed bag white.
Yeah.
And then, so probably, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, we actually did one of those, our family. So my name used to be O'Byrne many generations ago. And I guess, you know, they come across, Irish are persecuted. They put the O in the middle, the whole thing. So I thought I was quite Irish. And then my brother did one of those 23andMe things. And it's like, yeah, I'm like 13% or something.
Ah, no, I don't. Yeah. I wasn't going to help my brother for this, but I will. He has a Murphy like family crest tattoo that is very Irish. And I have still not seen ample evidence that it has anything to do with our particular line of Murphy and isn't just like
that's great
some pub's logo or something.
My brother also has an Irish tattoo. That is hilarious. Yeah. Well, everyone, for some reason, people, you know, love the Irish.
Yeah.
Love them here.
Yeah. I mean, why not? It's a fun occasion. We've got the St. Patrick's Day parade here on Sunday, grand marshaled by Jack Armstrong, Raptors color analyst. There was a great piece at The Ringer this week about Jack, written by my pal Danny Chow, which everyone should go check out. And just, you know, if you're out there enjoying it, if you do what I have done every year up until now, like going back to, I think, my second year of university, this year is like the end of a tradition. It's the first time with the asterisks for the lockdown season. The first time I haven't gotten together with like my like early undergrad university buddies to watch one of the first 2 days of March Madness.
Yeah.
Because I got to do this.
Well, it's part of growing up. You know, St. Paddy's Day takes a different meaning as you go through the years, particularly when you stop drinking, It becomes much less important.
Well, it's mostly about the basketball for me. Like, like I know it's St. Patrick's Day, and it was a reason to have friends up to university or whatever, and certainly a reason to participate in those extracurriculars. But for me, it's mostly just the way to remember when March Madness is coming on. And, you know, for as much as March Madness is kind of the Hoopheads signifier of, you know, it's a basketball fan's version of the little groundhog coming out of his hole, right? It's like if Duke blows it, winter's done. But until Duke is out, it's not spring yet.
So. Well, it's also kind of the beginning of sports nirvana. Like, I mean, NHL playoffs start soon, NBA playoffs not long after, college hockey, Frozen Four if you care, the basketball, the Masters starts, baseball starts. Like, it is April and October are the 2 months.
Say the one you're forgetting.
What is one of my?
If you're gonna put the Masters in there, you also have to include my Masters. WrestleMania's in 2 weeks.
No, I don't have to put that in there. No one needs to include that.
Yeah, but you're right though. It's close. April 15th, NBA and NHL playoffs begin. NBA has their little play-in tournament before that, but that weekend is kind of when things will kick off. And we are less than 2 weeks from the Toronto Blue Jays season opener down in St. Louis on March 30th. So lots of exciting stuff. Let's talk about the stuff that's not very exciting right now and what's going on with the Toronto Maple Leafs for this last month or so, where, I mean, mostly we're just trying to get to the middle of April in good health, but we're not without topics. The big one tonight will be that Luke Shen is returning and making his SBA debut 2.0.
Yes.
What do you see? I know we talked a little bit about this at the trade deadline, but it feels worth revisiting because he did get in a couple games and then was away for the birth of his child and is going to have to get reacclimated here over these last dozen plus games. What does his role look like to you down the stretch here?
You know, I think the best use of Luke Shen is to look back at how Tampa Bay used him when they won their Stanley Cups. He played 11 games for Tampa Bay, and when he played, he was Victor Hedman's partner. So you think, oh, wow, then he played a ton. It's like, no, somehow he still played like 12 minutes. So they put him with a guy who, you know, he could be reliable defensively for. He could only play in certain situations. He was fine when he was in, fine when he was out. Good personality to have around, around a guy who gave you everything, you know, at all times. So for the Leafs, I see a way for that to work. I don't love that they are 11-7, but when he's in, I think it makes a little bit of sense, and maybe that gives you the opportunity for Shen to play some with Riley here and there, but they got to figure this out quick with how they're going to use him.
So Shen, over those two Tampa Bay Stanley Cup runs, and, you know, ostensibly given that he was still only 30 at the time, this was an even sharper version of Luke Shen than might be skating up and down the ice at this point. He only played about 200 minutes total over those two full Stanley Cup runs with Tampa Bay. When you, and I got thinking about this, we were thinking about it at the deadline, but you wrote that great piece for Sportsnet.ca last week about how and to what extent the Leafs should get ready to match Tampa Bay's physicality. Mm-hmm. When you went through that and went through some of the tape from last year's series, some of the numbers on what Tampa Bay is doing this year, does the Luke Shen addition and this push to get him in the mix down the stretch, like how much of that is general defensive depth and how much of that is, no, this is for the Tampa Bay series because we've got to have someone a little more functional than Kyle Clifford and Wayne Simmonds doing that?
Yeah, I love that conversation, and it's a real point of debate even in my own brain. Is like Tampa Bay has led the NHL in penalty minutes in 9 of the last 11 seasons and have been top 2 in all 11. Like this is a part of the fabric of how they have success. They get in your face and they jaw and they make you mad. You know, for the Leafs, it's like we've seen Austin Matthews not engage Ben Chiarot, and people go, you know, it's embarrassing, or, you know, whatever you think is important. You know, you've seen Brad Marchand ragdoll the Sedins. You can't do nothing sometimes. And so for the Leafs, having a guy who can at least go up to someone in Tampa Bay and be like, excuse me, stop it. You know, like, please, would you please not do that? It's just nice to have someone like that. And that's not to say you want to play Tampa's game, change, you know, what makes you the Toronto Maple Leafs or anything of that sort. It's just, it's going to be physical and they're going to be in the Leafs' face. It's nice to have a few guys who've broken a nose before to say, at least we're here to answer if you have a question.
The way you laid it out, and I didn't think this at the time of your article because I hadn't gone back to tie this together. It's going to be convoluted, so stay with me.
All right.
But the Oscars were recently, right? And Brendan Fraser won an Oscar. Mm-hmm. So I, of course, went back and watched my favorite Brendan Fraser movie, Encino Man.
It's the best one.
And in that movie, there is a time where the bully punches him in the face and he does nothing. He just takes it. And there are a couple people that are like, oh my God, he just took it. He didn't knock him down. And there's an element of respect for that. But then there are also a bunch of people who are like, how could you just like take that and not do anything? But then later in the movie, the bully picks on his friend and then Brendan Fraser ragdolls him. Right. And I thought of that in the way you were laying out, like it's one thing for Austin Matthews to Don Draper Ben Chiarot. Like, I'm not thinking about you at all. I'm Austin Matthews. You're not going to get in my head.
Right.
But if it's a whole team of that, then Tampa Bay is playing so comfortably. And, you know, we don't need to do the whole thing of, well, you got to fight in the playoffs, whatever. Like the fact that Jake McCabe leading this team in fights is like the 8th good thing that got mentioned about him when they acquired him.
Yeah.
That to me is exactly what you want, right? You want a guy who does a lot of other things. And if you need it, you can call on that. So when it comes to what Luke Shen's, let's say things look good. Let's say he clicks, he looks like he's capable of contributing to a playoff team in a first round series. What do you think the high end of his role is? Is it that 12 minutes a game where he's, you know, not sheltered minutes wise because he'll be playing in the defensive zone, I'd imagine, but paired with probably a Brody type to just like, you know, insulate him a little bit more?
Yeah. You know, I think what's happened since the trade deadline, I look at the way their decor is constructed, and it's like going into the deadline, you had Riley Brody and, you know, Geo Hall or Geo Lilly, and then you had that third pair that was Sandy Lilligren. And I think if you asked Dubas or Shanahan or any guys that time and said, what if instead of Sandy Lilligren as your third pair was Jake McCabe and Luke Shen, would you prefer the look of your team then? I think they'd have been like, oh boy, you know, like that sounds much better, much better. And really, they have that opportunity now to send over a couple guys that defend as a priority. They're hard-nosed guys, tough to play against. So, you know, I don't know that he's ever going to be an integral piece to this team, but I just think for them, having an element for Tampa Bay's forwards to not let them have their way with the Leafs D, like Sandin going back on pucks was one of his weaknesses against hard forechecks. Liljegren can occasionally be caught standing by a player in front of the net. I just think they wanted to have some guys that say, yeah, you know, we're going to get a cross check in the back if you stand here. They just wanted to have some element of that, and they didn't, and they went out and got it. So a lot of people support that decision.
So with Luke Shen back now, even playing seven defensemen, there are a couple guys sitting in the press box every night. It's Justin Hall who's drawing out tonight so Shen can come in. Timothy Liljegren took his couple of turns out of the rotation, and I've thought has maybe not looked as good as before the trade deadline in those opportunities. Maybe that's a confidence thing you could speak to, but in the 11-7 experiment in general, are you a fan of that? Are you cool with that until Ryan O'Reilly comes back or Matthew Nyes arrives or whenever some 12th forward forces their hand?
Yeah, it's funny. They seem to go, so I don't love it. I'll just start there. I don't like it. Really, I don't like it, period. I should end that thought. But they seem to really want to make everyone who becomes a Toronto Maple Leaf feel welcome and included. And so there is like a personal element of getting the best out of people when they feel a part of it. And Erik Gustafsson was playing 22 minutes for the Washington Capitals when they traded for him. He's pretty clearly their 7 or 8. But they didn't want to trade for a guy playing that much and say, you can't play for us.
Yeah, you're Morgan Riley's insurance because we need someone to play on the power play if he gets hurt.
Yeah, so just watch the next month and a half and we'll tell you if we need you. Like, you know, Gustafsson, not going to get to know the guys the same way. He's not going to be in the same meetings. He's not going to feel a part of it. So how important is that element for someone like him? And how important will that even be that he's important? Those are questions they seem to value, that this guy, you know, feels like he is a piece of this. So I guess that's why it's happening to some extent is trying to keep the D involved. But yeah, the second they have these, you know, their full complement of forwards back, I want to see him get it figured out pretty soon. Like Tampa Bay is rolling pretty much with the same look they've had for 6 months. And, you know, I forget who we had on recently. Ken Hitchcock might've been said something like, you know, a lot of coaches, like Hall of Fame coaches, talking about preparing for Game 7. One of the things they don't want to do is throw something new at their team. They want the guys to play and not have to think about different elements. I would like the Toronto Maple Leafs to not have to be like, who am I on the ice with, and be comfortable with their line mates by the time they get to Game 1.
That's a good thing. And I guess that's where the 7D comes in, is I guess everyone gets a little bit more opportunity to play with different pairs because more guys are getting in the mix, but nobody is getting like the big sample of minutes together. It's tough as someone who is obviously trying to watching the games, of course, but trying to look at the numbers and see if we can pull anything out of a 15-20 game sample.
Everyone's got 8 minutes together.
Exactly. I think you make a good point in wanting to make sure the new guys are in the mix and feeling involved. I think we know a couple. We don't know how they'll line up, maybe, but I think Gio, Riley, McCabe, Brody, we know are going to be in every playoff game, barring injury. My gut, and based on merit, I think so far, is that Gustafsson's a press box guy unless something were to happen to Riley or the power play really starts to struggle. That leaves Hall and Liljegren, who have both had better seasons this year than last, but who have been a little up and down lately, and then Luke Shen. Do you have a lean on who you would like to see as the fifth and sixth defenseman if the playoffs started tomorrow?
You know, this one is really hard for me because I know all the analytics on Timothy Liljegren and how good he's been and how he's a big part of their future. And so, you know, he should be in. You know, he should be. Absolutely. But it's the old trying to beat the hockey guy out of me, where it's like, I just would love to have Luke Shen in at the start of the series to have that physical element. And then Justin Hall for me is a guy who I spend my career defending at this point, you know.
Well, and if you made this point in your breakdown of the Leafs Lightning physicality element, that if Tampa has their way, a lot of this series would be played on special teams because the Leafs are better at 5-on-5. Yep. And if Tampa can force it into special teams where the two sides are a little more even, well, who is not your most, probably your second most trusted defenseman on the PK?
He's their number one guy, I think. I mean, mm-hmm. I think in terms of ice time, it's either him or Brody. I'm not sure which one.
But I guess I was just going on like my trust of them. I still have Brody a little higher.
For sure. I agree.
But yeah, he plays the lion's share of the PK minutes. And if that's what you think this series is going to be, there's probably a Justin Hall spot. And that, the way you just laid that out, it maybe means Liljegren's up in the press box.
It's tough. You know, like, you know, Kipper was even saying today on our show, like, just, you know, with Gustafsson, he's going to try to get on the power play, and it's kind of this special. He's like a field goal kicker. Like, you wait till we need you. But when Justin Hall plays, he plays 22 minutes. He actually averages over 20 minutes per game, which is fourth on the team. You know, like, there's uses for him. He's protecting a lead to the end of the game. He's playing the top lines. He's killing penalties. So he's in for me. And I know mm-hmm. he's out tonight, and I think it's good for everyone to get their chances and get their looks, and I think that's part of it.
First of four back-to-backs over this final month, too. So I think
they have four back-to-backs?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awful. I didn't realize it was
I mean, you're going to get lots of Samsonov and Murray, and I know we can talk the goalie stuff, but yeah, if there were ever a month to have nine defensemen as you're trying to keep everyone healthy for the postseason.
That's brutal.
Yeah, I believe just about every weekend the rest of the way they've got a back-to-back.
And I wonder then if they don't call him in, they don't call Liljegren in, they don't call these guys in and say, look at the guys we have. You're going to be in, you know, or you're going to play. You're going to get your chances, but you point at the guy who shouldn't play. You know, like, you know, we have tough decisions here, and it's not about that you're playing poorly. Justin Hall's actually, I thought, played very well lately. He's been physical. And I do think there's an element of, like, it's back-to-back. Someone else is getting a turn tonight. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about a listen. We still love you. I know that's hard for a player, but you know, everyone has their individual motivations. Justin Hall is a UFA. You know, his contract mm-hmm. hinges on how much he gets in and all that. But yeah, he's going to end up playing for them. You've seen the way Keefe and Dubas use him. They love him.
Last one on the D-mixes, because we're going to talk about this a ton over the next month, I'm sure. But do you subscribe at all to having a different game plan for road games with the defensive group than you do for home games? Like, I know in your article on last year, regardless of where that series started, they wanted the tone setter game one.
Yeah.
But if you project ahead, maybe there is a tilt when you do or don't have last change.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, in a way that you could shelter Liljegren and make sure that he's playing in the offensive zone, or, you know, in terms of dictating starts. It depends. You know, I think there is something to that, and it's definitely a good thought. You know, one thing with the Leafs that I have some concern about is, like, this reactionary nature and everything we're talking about to Tampa Bay. Okay, we need these guys because this is what Tampa Bay does. Okay, we're going to start, you know, they're just so worried about Tampa Bay instead of being like, here's how we're optimized. Here's how we're the best group. We're going to put our best players in and make Tampa chase us around and try to beat us. You know, I worry about overthinking it too much sometimes. And
that's what I'm here for.
Well, it's what Sports Talk Radio is. You know, to some extent, I would like to see them say, okay, this is how we think we're the best. Sorry, Gustafsson, you can see why you're out these last few games. Sorry, you know, whatever. I just like to see them go with their best look regardless of where they play.
So one thing, because we're on the Gustafsson thing in situations where he could have value or could not have value, the power play is fascinating to me. So the third in the league, they're a fraction of a point behind Tampa Bay for power play percentage and you know, for a second, third. This is a better power play than they've had at any time in this era by percentage, except for last year. Yeah. And they're doing all of this, by the way, in a season where Austin Matthews hasn't quite been Austin Matthews. Shooting percentage is down overall. Shooting percentage is down on the power play. So if we're to believe that the hand thing is behind him and we're going to see a better version of Austin Matthews the rest of the way, as we saw the last week and change, maybe the power play has even higher to go.
Yeah.
But that was the case last year, and they've had a pretty good power play in years past. Has anything changed? And I, you know, I can watch as much tape on this, and I can't really pick. I know they changed some of the guys' roles and stuff last year. It looks to me like a very similar power play where you just have five really good players.
Yeah.
And okay, stop it then.
Yeah.
Well, and that's cool, but it hasn't really worked in the postseason. Are you any more confident right now in this power play group in a playoff series than you were in years prior?
I guess if I have more confidence, they've done a couple of things throughout the year, which is just have different flank guys. Sometimes Willie will play on the flank, and sometimes it's Mitch and Austin. I can't remember any of their goals on the power play that really seemed to come off. All right, they're in the 1-3-1, they're set up, and Mitch went seam to Matthews, who scored, or it went seam to the other guy, or Riley hit a one-timer. It's all off kind of low plays and broken plays and entries, and as you're, to your point, they got five of the best players in the league.
Yeah.
You know, at least four of the best offensive guys in the league, so they're going to score goals. They got more guys on the ice. So, you know, like there's an element to me where it's like, you point to their power play success rate, and it's just a product of having good people. And I don't see a lot of structure that's any different. They're still in a 1-3-1. I don't see many different looks aside from letting different people be in different spots. So, you know, that gives me a little more hope than past years. Also knowing that they've been frustrated there before and really bearing down on it. But other than that, it's pretty much the same look to me.
Yeah, which is it's got to be tough as a front office and a coaching staff when something works so well.
Yeah.
And you have it this hanging over you that, hey, a couple times it didn't work very well in the playoffs. Do you think that that's just a rough seven games against a good team? Or in the case of the Montreal series, a rough seven games against a bad team? I don't know. Like I could absolutely understand having a cold series against Tampa Bay, even though Vasilevsky wasn't like world eater Vasilevsky in that series, but some of the earlier ones, less so. So that's something I don't know what they could do that I would be more confident in than, hey, we're the second best power play in the league, and it's better than all the years it was already really good.
Right.
I don't know what else they could show me, but I'm still not.
High bar for us, eh?
Yeah. Well, that's this was always the Raptors thing in the Kyle DeMar era too, right? Which is all this stuff works so well in the regular season. Can we figure out why it doesn't in the playoffs? Yeah. And sometimes there were tactical reasons, and sometimes it was because LeBron James can pretend to drink a beer and spin the ball in front of your face, and there is nothing mentally you can do to get over that.
He's
because they're
out
so
finger.
Far
just take it from him.
Yeah, he's so far in your head. So we'll see how that goes. Ilya Samsonov's going to start tonight. Matt Murray's going to get the start tomorrow against his former team. Interesting way that they laid out a four-game week where Samsonov actually started two of the closest games together against the two best teams that they played this week. Murray gets the two easier ones. I mentioned the four back-to-backs the rest of the way, so we're going to see both of these guys a lot. Does Samsonov getting Colorado and Carolina tell you anything about, you know, the 1A, 1B hierarchy right now?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's like with people where you say, you know, pay attention to what they do, not what they say. And so when Sheldon Keefe comes out and says, I know Murray's numbers look bad, but he's actually been great. You know, I'm not listening to that so much as the point you're making right now, which is they don't use him against good player, you know, good teams in big spots, and they don't want him playing too regularly. And it seems to me like they've kind of made up their mind on Samsonov, which seems to be the correct decision. I know that they want the Murray thing to work. He's got another year in the deal, and they kind of made a bet on a guy other people saw as risky and all that. But
seems like a good dude.
Yeah, great guy. You know, like it would be a wonderful success story to see a guy win cups, kind of hit the bottom. Luke Shen did it, and then come back and win cups again. I mean, we would love that. I don't know if Shen's journey wasn't quite that, but
it'd also be very amusing if Matt Murray just had a career where at the end it was like, he was never really that reliable as a regular season guy, but come playoff time, like he's Robert Horry, but for goalies, where it's just like, how does this guy have six rings when he wasn't like in the rotation at times in the playoffs?
There's a luck and timing element to all this stuff. And you know, we've seen stretches of play for Murray this year where you go, oh, you know, maybe he's there. I think they got two guys right now where they say, maybe that guy gets hot at the right time. And that's what hockey playoffs are.
JD Bunkus on the JD Bunkus podcast this week had a guest, and I'm drawing a blank on who it was, Kevin Woodley.
Okay, yeah.
He had on. Great and Kevin guy. Woodley pointed out something that we've kind of been tracking all year, and it's that, well, these two goalies, even when they have similar numbers, come about it very differently.
Yeah.
One stops all the high danger stuff and occasionally lets in a softie. One stops all the stuff he's supposed to stop. And then if you give up a good chance, well, you gave it up and you're toast.
Yeah.
Do you think, like, are we far enough into the season? Both of these guys have played enough games. The scouting reports are out there that if you're a defensive group or you're one of the checking lines, does that get into your head? Do you play a little differently knowing one guy is the guy who stops what he's supposed to, but you can't give up chances and one guy can kind of bail you out?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. You know, like that is something that would be a defenseman's sort of mindset for Morgan Riley. Like maybe you feel like, you know, I've got this opportunity to jump up, but I know that if I get burned, it's going in our net.
Right.
You know, maybe you feel like you can take that chance with Samsonov in net a bit more. I do feel like in terms of replicating your regular season success, like I like Samsonov's odds of suddenly stopping the ones from distance more than I like Murray's odds of suddenly stopping the high danger ones.
Yes, that makes sense. Like, because the low danger ones are low danger.
They're low danger.
They're the ones you're supposed to stop. Yeah, it's you know, ceiling skill versus floor skill. And I think in the playoffs, you want the ceiling
skill. You want the ceiling skill in hopes of a guy getting hot. So I'm pretty firmly entrenched in the Samsonov camp, and I just can't believe here we are, this whole team, all these trades, and it's built on, you know, hope the goalie plays well, but that's hockey, man.
Man, imagine you were still with the Marlies and you were seeing what Joe Wall's been doing all year and all of last year, and just like, sorry, man. Like how do you put an arm around that guy and be like, just wait until, I don't know, if Samsonov comes back because he's an RFA, not a UFA, like wait for 2024, bud?
Well, and yeah, you know, you're asking Matt Murray to play six hockey games between now and the end of the season.
Fair.
You may very well get to play in playoffs, and if Samsonov's not great, you might be the starter. Like, there's a 10% chance Joe Woll plays before game four of the playoffs.
Sure, but the Marlies have a championship to win as well. They've got Bobby McMahon back now. They're making signings down the stretch. They signed one of those, like, pre-ELC to Forsberg.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
One of those, like, cheat the salary cap pre-ELC PTOs the other day.
Chinnikov or something.
Yeah.
Too. Whatever.
I'm not trying to dismiss those guys.
I just don't know who they are.
No, of course. And I'm sure I butchered the pronunciation on Forsberg as well. But yeah, they've got a championship to win. I know I'm keeping you too long. You've got a weekend and a family to get on with.
Good.
Last one for you. The St. Patrick's Day kits.
Yes.
They're wearing. You a fan?
I am. I just feel like the green is a little too neon for me. I could use a little calmer green color. I feel like it's very aggressive, but I do like them.
So you want like the green you're wearing, not the green I'm wearing?
Like a mint. Give me a minty green.
Okay, so mine's too green. Okay, for anyone, I'm wearing like a Ricky Henderson Oakland A's green shirt. That's
how about
too
this Perrier
green.
Bottle green?
There you go.
All right.
Non-brand specific. Spicy water.
Now I owe Perrier money.
No, they owe you money.
Okay, good. That's much better.
Charge at the game. Justin Bourne, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Keep up the great work on Kipper and Bourne, and you have a lovely weekend.
Thanks, pal. Appreciate it.
That was Justin Bourne of Real Kipper and Bourne of Leafs Talk. Leafs Talk with Sam McKee tonight? Are you on with him?
I'm not. It's Brent Gunning with him.
Ah, okay. You and JD getting the Friday night off. Unbelievable. Poor Sammy. Sam McKee and Brent Gunning will have that for you after the Leafs game tonight. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to try to see what the Toronto Blue Jays' future salary structure may look like. Tim Britton of The Athletic, normally a Mets guy, but he does a lot of great MLB-wide stuff, had a whole series this week projecting next contracts for very young players who teams might want to lock up, players who are close-ish to free agency who teams might want to extend, and players who are very close to free agency who have UFA status at the end of this year to worry about. We'll go through all of those because the Jays have guys in every category. Tim Britton joins us next on Fan Drive Time on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome back to Fan Drive Time. I'm Blake Murphy. No Ben Ennis today. That's sad. He's losing a whole day. Edwin Diaz losing a whole year. Joining us now from The Athletic, staff writer covering the New York Mets and a little bit everything lately, Tim Britton. Tim, how are you, man?
I'm better now. I mean, Third Eye Blind, that was my first concert, so thank you very much for that intro.
Wow, your first concert. I've never seen them live, but I maintain that that debut album is among the very best debut rock albums.
Yeah, it's about time for me to go back and listen to it. It's been a little while now.
There you go. Happy to push your Friday in that direction. Tim, want to talk to you a lot about your contract extension series at The Athletic. But before we do that, you do cover the Mets. There was the Edwin Diaz injury this week. We found out today, as kind of expected around the WBC stuff, that insurance will cover it, but insurance doesn't drop one of the best closers in the game back into your bullpen. What's the feeling around the New York Mets right now in terms of just how quickly they need to address this and how aggressively they need to address this?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the good things for the Mets is that they have people in their bullpen, and most notably, it's David Robertson with closing experience and closing experience in the city of New York, which can be a little bit different than elsewhere. I think he's eighth on the active list in saves. He's got more than 150 saves. When they signed him, there were people with the team who said this is, you know, a hedge against anything happening to Diaz. You wouldn't have thought, you know, Diaz is the one guy really in their bullpen, the one guy in their pitching staff who's really in that prime of his career. He's 28. A lot of the staff is older than that. You wouldn't have expected him to be the guy to get hurt. But I think the Mets are comfortable with Robertson, Adam Ottavino, maybe Brooks Raley late in games to start the year. But certainly, you know, the bullpen is an area you can remake over the course of the season. There won't be another Edwin Diaz available in June or July, but there might be someone who fits better than, you know, rushing out and trying to make a overpay for a reliever now or sign, you know, someone like Zach Britton or something like that. You know, maybe they do that to supplement, but I don't think that's the answer to Edwin Diaz's absence.
Well, it would be nice to see Zach Britton get some sort of love, because I don't know if you know this, he's actually still in the visitor's dugout here in Toronto. He's been there since 2016 in the wild card game. No one has gone and got him yet, so it'd be nice for the Mets to do that. Mets a bit of a rough spring. There's the Edwin Diaz situation. Jose Quintana is not expected back until July-ish now due to a rib injury, and he was kind of one of the lower cost additions there too. The Mets got a lot of headlines this offseason for the big ticket items at the top of the roster. How do you feel about how they've gone about adding depth and managing depth as well? Are they positioned to, you know, no one's replacing Edwin Diaz, but, you know, you can kind of cobble together, like you said, the bullpen pieces there. Is there the same amount of depth on the starting side to withstand the Quintana injury as well?
I mean, I would say on the starting side is probably where they did the best job of building depth in the offseason, and that was by bringing, you know, they replaced Jacob DeGrom with Justin Verlander. They replaced Chris Bassitt, who's now in Toronto, and Taijuan Walker with Kodai Senga and Jose Quintana. And that kept two guys, David Peterson and Tylor McGill, who have pitched in the major leagues over the last 2 years, Peterson for the last three, and has had reasonable success in the major leagues. Peterson, I think, had a 3.3 ERA in over 100 innings last year. Kept them as their sixth and seventh starters. So now, you know, those are the two guys competing for Quintana's spot for the first half of the season. They've already talked about wanting to keep their regular five starters fresh more during the year, which maybe means going to a six-man rotation at times. So I think they've done a decent job for building that depth. But, you know, this is a team that last year, not only did most guys kind of perform the way you expect them to perform over the course of the season, but also they didn't suffer a lot of injuries. Obviously, they were without Jacob DeGrom for 4 months. That's a huge injury. And Max Scherzer didn't have his usual 32-start year for them. But from a position player side of things, and in the bullpen in particular, they didn't experience the kind of injuries that they've gone through already this spring. And so that's going to test that depth a little bit more maybe than it was tested last year.
Tim, you mentioned Chris Bassitt outbound from the New York Mets. He joins the Toronto Blue Jays. We've gotten to know him a little bit so far. You know, the eight pitches, the funkiness with trying to throw hitters off guard with the pitch clock and things like that. What can we expect from Chris Bassitt over the course of the season? He's a guy who had a pretty good run with the Mets there. Seems like a fascinating cover from a beat writer standpoint as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think fascinating is a good word to describe Chris. He was a lot of fun to cover last season to get to know him. You know, him and Mark Canna had come over from Oakland to New York, and both of them were kind of guys who you know are pretty good, but you don't get to see a lot when they play in Oakland all the time. And Bassitt, with the number of different pitches he throws, the way he thinks about pitching and the way he goes about trying to keep guys off balance, he's pretty candid and open about that. That's always fun from a beat writer's perspective. He's also just a really good pitcher. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't close the season the way he wanted to last year. Had a rough start in Atlanta the final Sunday of the season, which basically meant the Mets couldn't win the NL East, and then of course got outpitched in the finale of the wild card series by Joe Musgrove, and again the Mets lost to end their season, so that kind of left a sour taste in a lot of Mets fans mouths. But you look at the overall body of work he was able to give them on the season. He was a really good number three starter, and I think he fits well with what Toronto's looking for in its rotation.
Sure hope so. A little extra stability through the middle of that rotation could go a long way after the tough years that Jose Berríos and Yusei Kikuchi had last year. Someone who didn't have a rough year at all last year was Alek Manoah, and I use him to turn the page to this excellent, excellent series you had at The Athletic this week. Contract extension week at The Athletic. Everyone should go check that out. You did that in a couple different parts. There were guys who are close to free agency, like a Matt Chapman. There were guys who are in their arb years but are maybe getting close enough to free agency to talk extension, like a Vlad, like a Bo. And then, you know, some of the rising stars in the league, the pre-arb guys that are always tough to put a value on because it comes to individual risk preference and things like that. And Alek Manoah was a part of that group. I thought it was fascinating that in coming up with a potential contract extension number for him, you were basically like, well, Spencer Strider's kind of the only guy you can really compare him to. I think Jays fans would be thrilled to hear that. They love Manoah. One of the other complicating factors is he could be a super two guy instead of a regular ARB guy. But what went into how you laid out a potential Alek Manoah contract extension at this point could look like? Take us through the process a little bit there.
Yeah, I mean, as the week went on, we got the guys farther and farther away from free agency, which made it tougher and tougher and more speculative because there's just, you know, there's fewer guys who sign extensions at that point in their careers. I was kind of thankful that Atlanta has signed so many of those guys. There are some comps from that team, and Corbin Carroll's as well with Arizona recently helps. But with Manoah, I mean, you're looking at a guy who is, you know, an elite level performer very early in his career, kind of like Strider. And historically, there's not a lot of pitchers in particular who sign extensions this far out from free agency when they show that kind of potential early on. So you kind of game it out. He's got 5 years until he hits free agency. The first one is basically a league minimum year. You know, he'll make somewhere between $700,000 and probably $950,000 or $1 million. And then next year would be in 2024. That would be probably his first year of arbitration as a Super 2 player. He's kind of close to the cutoff line, but usually would make it as a Super 2 player, which means he gets a fourth year of arbitration rather than just three, which could mean a pretty big difference in how much he earns before hitting free agency. You know, David Price was a Super 2 player, had 4 years. He made about $48 million in arbitration. Corbin Burns was not a Super 2. He's on pace basically to make $32, $33 million in arbitration. So that's one big difference. And then you try to figure out, okay, if Manoah were hitting free agency right now, how much per year would he get compared to some other guys? And that's where you have to you know, guys don't hit free agency at his age and with one good year. They hit it with three, four, five good years at a later age. So it's tough to make that comparison. But I thought, you know, about $25, $26 million a year. That's kind of how the Braves valued Strider's free agency in that deal with him. And so I kind of used that as a kind of a proxy for what Manoah might be able to get at that stage in his career and came out with, I think, a six-year, $85 million contract is what it would look like, which, you know, if you sign it, doesn't seem like it's when Carlos Rodon is getting 6 years and $162 million, it seems like that's a bargain for Manoah. But you have to understand that through arbitration, his salary is going to be suppressed a bit. He's not on the open market the way Rodon was. That's why it might seem low for a pitcher of his quality.
Yeah, and that's where the individual risk preference comes in. I'm sure every Jays fan, if you said 6 years, 85, or with the option you laid out, 7 years, 110, every Jays fan is signing that Alek Manoah to those contracts right now. It was a similar thing with Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who were in that tier, in that article you did, focusing on the guys who are into ARB years, but a couple years away from free agency. Bo Bichette obviously signing a three-year, $33.6 million deal with the Jays this offseason to cover his arbitration years. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. still going through the arbitration process as one of those super twos you discussed who will make a little bit more money in the arbitration process than an average player. Mentioned we don't need to go through the process necessarily for each individual guy, but all three of those guys, when you did kind of your wrap up of this week, were all in the category of this probably makes a lot of sense for the team, maybe a little less so for the player. Would an extension for either of those three guys, Vlad, Bo, or Manoah, at this stage surprise you a little bit?
I don't know that probably Manoah would seem like the least likely to sign at this point, you know, and I guess in overall, yeah, I'd be surprised if any of them signed it right now, you know, with Bichette, I think he's been the sixth best shortstop over the last 3 years, by according to Fangraphs wins above replacement. And the five guys in front of him have all signed free agent contracts in that time worth an average of $250 million. So he's on pace to be that guy when he does hit free agency in 3 years. And then I think the other complicating factor that I mentioned in there is with both Guerrero and Bichette, you know, these are guys whose dad played in Major League Baseball. So they're, you know, kind of securing that multi-generational wealth that you hear about sometimes when these guys sign extensions before free agency. That's not as big a factor for them. That doesn't mean there isn't any number that the Blue Jays could sign them to before free agency. It just means it's maybe a little bit higher than it would be for you or me if we were baseball players. So I think that's probably the thing that keeps me from thinking that something is going to happen right away with those guys, is that they're on pace to make a lot of money in free agency when they get there, and they don't need to secure their current generation, their next generation, the way another player might.
So let's take it to the more immediate, and I probably should have led with the most immediate one, but whatever. Matt Chapman is 30 years old. He's in the last year of a 2-year, $25 million deal he worked out with the Blue Jays to cover his last two arbitration years. With how many players around baseball have already signed extensions to avoid free agency after this season, Matt Chapman stands to be one of the top names in the free agent market. The Blue Jays also happen to have a couple of their best prospects who project to be corner infielders or second baseman with not a lot of spots there. It's a very fascinating situation where Matt Chapman is unquestionably better than Addison Barger and Aurelvis Martinez right now, but with how much the Jays have laid out to other players, how much they may have to lay out to Vlad and Bo, I could certainly see a scenario where Matt Chapman explores free agency at the end of this season. What would that free agent market look like for Matt Chapman, who, again, 30 years old, one of the best defensive third basemen in baseball, and if he plays this year like he plays last year, by WAR or WRC plus or whichever metric you prefer, going to be one of the top names on the market?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really is an interesting time for Toronto, because this is when you start thinking, okay, how are we going to build not just the best 2023 and 2024 Blue Jays team, but how can we best preserve, you know, the talent we have in-house that's going to hit free agency in 25 and 26 and 27. That's the game you've got to play when you're in a front office at this point. You know, and Chapman benefits from the fact that Manny Machado is not going to be on the open market anymore. He signed the monster extension with San Diego. And so you're looking at the free agent market. There's Shohei Ohtani, who's going to be basically in a class by himself. And then, you know, you start thinking of the best position players available, and it's going to be, you know, Chapman or Teoscar Hernandez, who you're familiar with, of course. You know, it's not the huge kind of class that we've seen some other years. And so that puts him in a pretty good spot. When I was looking at players who've kind of had similar production, another name you're familiar with, Josh Donaldson, at a later point in his career, had kind of done the same kind of thing. You know, he obviously had the injury that hurt him going into free agency finally. But he was a guy who signed in back-to-back years. The one-year deal with Atlanta was for $23 million. For the one season, and the next deal with Minnesota was 4 years at $23 million per. And so that was kind of where I pegged Chapman's value. But that, you know, that's pegging it now before free agency. When you get to the open market, it changes a little bit, and especially one that is maybe not as competitive as it would be otherwise. You can see that go up a little bit. But I think, you know, he's another guy who's going to get a nine-figure contract at some point here. And be worth most of it, I think.
And it might be a case where, you know, the two sides have to look at it as, hey, it was a great couple years together, and best of luck on your next contract. Glad you got the money. But, you know, there are only so many guys you can give that money to. The guy that I would give all the money to, and Tim, you know, we used to be colleagues at The Athletic. I know that sometimes that internal thing for making tables in articles can be a little finicky. I don't believe you fit all the zeros necessary for Shohei into those little tables. I believe $1 bajillion is the estimated going rate. What do you, like, can you think of a baseball free agent who could cause as much frenzy and hold up the market to the same degree as Shohei if he hits the market this winter?
Well, those tables are the hardest part of doing this whole exercise. You probably know. You know, with with Ohtani, like, you go into a free agency period, and you know, when you're at the winter meetings, there's always like that one player, you know, there's that one big starter, he's holding up the whole starting pitching market. There's that one good outfielder, he's holding up the position player hitter market. You know, Ohtani's going to be holding up both. And that's what's going to be so wild about this offseason, because they're, you know, I do this whole thing looking at comparable players, and he doesn't really fit the model necessarily, because I've got one tab for starters, for starting pitchers, and one tab for position players. I had to start an Ohtani tab for both, and it's just him in it. You know, he's such a unicorn of a player that it'll be really interesting to see how teams go about trying to value what he brings on both sides of it. Do you just go ahead and say, okay, as a hitter, he's like this, and as a pitcher, he's like this. Let's add that together, in which case you can get a player who's worth $55, $60 million a year on the open market. I tend to think it's going to be a little bit less than that, but it's still going to, you know, there's a very real chance that his next deal starts with a five and is nine figures long. So it's going to be such a crazy offseason to watch. You know, the Mets are going to be a team that's really interested in their general manager. Billy Epler signed him in Anaheim. I think, you know, that's going to be the dominant story of the offseason for however long it takes for Shohei to decide where to go.
I don't know, though. Do you think the Mets owner would make a big splash financially? Do you think he'd throw money around it? I don't know if that's in Steve Cohen's DNA, right?
Right. You know, we'll have to see if he's willing to open the wallet on it. And, you know, the other thing with Ohtani that's so interesting is you can try to value what he brings on the field. But just in terms of marketability, that's a whole other level of even the best player in baseball, even someone like Mike Trout, you know, that Ohtani is brings in fans a way that I don't think we've seen a player do in a long time. And that's another kind of harder to quantify part of how much value he brings to a franchise.
I can't quantify my excitement, but I'll tell you that those are the games that you circle immediately on. I think one of the Jays' first series this year is at the Angels, and already you're like, yeah, NHL and NBA playoffs are starting, but I'm going to completely disrupt the sleep schedule and the work schedule to watch those games. So looking forward to that. Tim, excellent, excellent series. I really enjoyed it and appreciate you coming on. Not quite to the extent, though, that I'm not still rooting against your Duke Blue Devils tomorrow in both men's and women's March Madness action. I'm sorry, but my rooting is going behind Tennessee on the men's side, behind Iona on the women's side. I'm sorry, man.
What, people don't like Duke? What? This is the first I'm hearing of this.
Yeah, completely original thought on my end. But, man, if you're a basketball fan, hope you enjoy the madness these next couple of days.
Oh, definitely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Tim. Tim Britton of The Athletic does a great job covering the Mets there. And again, the contract extension series that was up all week at The Athletic. You can read a little bit more about the methodology Tim went about to come to some of those numbers for not just Toronto Blue Jays, who could be pending free agents or could be working on extensions next offseason, but players around the league, players like Teoscar Hernandez, who, by the way, I had friends in Seattle this week, and they sent me pictures of Teoscar like on all the marketing materials around Seattle, and yeah, you're gonna miss the guy, you're gonna miss that smile, but we'll see how Eric Swanson did not look great today, but it's just spring training, right? So who's to worry, and we haven't even seen Adam Macko yet. By the way, the Jays had a split squad day today. They played a pair of games against the Phillies. In one, Yusei Kikuchi threw 76 pitches, said after that he's feeling pretty good. It was mostly about getting the pitch total up. He did walk three guys again in 3 1/3 innings, so that's something to watch. In the other game, Chris Bassitt only gave up one earned run over five innings, but only one strikeout. Again, though, he spoke after about, you know, it was about getting up to 79 pitches, nothing else there. In a little bit of other news, by the way, we have Dan Shulman coming on a little later around 6:30, so we'll go deeper on Jays then. But to close off some items from earlier this week, Otto Lopez is back with the Jays. He's dealing with a bit of groin soreness, so he's going to get a couple days of rest. Doesn't sound like anyone's too concerned there. Drew Hutchison day-to-day with an oblique injury. And Ricky Tiedemann, his side session got pushed back again. It wasn't today. Now it's going to be tomorrow. So I don't know. Ben Ennis and his tinfoil theories about Ricky Tiedemann maybe continue to grow while he's at home enjoying March break. We're going to take a break of our own. When we come back, Haley McGoldrick, who's covering NCAA tournament for us here at Sportsnet. And then a little after that, John Axford, who pitched for Canada in the World Baseball Classic. And then Dan Shulman closes out the show with us. That's all next as Fan Drive Time continues on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.